Depleted uranium, as you well know, was used in the Gulf War. Some 300 tons were used in tank shells, I believe, and aircraft rockets and that sort of thing. DU is a compound which is about twice the density of lead. It has another glorious factor. When it strikes heavy metal like a tank, you know, the Russian tanks in Iraq are like that, I believe, it's a pyrotechnic. It burns. It doesn't go blunt. It actually burns a hole through this metal. And then when it gets inside the tank, it explodes. And that's the bad part. I mean, apart from the tank crew, of course, but it distributes billions of tiny particles of uranium residue. And I've forgotten the various numbers involved, but it's the type and danger. But it seems to be a very dangerous phenomenon. And then it goes into your lungs, and that's perhaps one of the reasons for the Gulf syndrome, is that what it's called? It's one of the reasons why the water supplies in the south of Iraq have been polluted. It goes into the ground, it goes into the root crops, it's consumed by the population, not just of the south, but actually root crops are going up to Baghdad and so on. And the incidence of cancer, if you've seen the film made by John Pilger, the surgeon, cancer surgeon in the Basra Hospital, who's a British-trained expert, believes that 40 to 45% of adults in the south of Iraq will die of some sort of cancer, prematurely from some form of cancer, picked up from the Gulf War period. Now, many of us think it's DU alone. Others will argue that it's DU compounded with some other toxic mix that may come from the destruction of chemical weapons, which U.S. forces did, or, you know, we don't quite know the answer. But DU seems to be an extremely dangerous commodity. Unfortunately, it's cheap and it's effective, and it's in the hands of, I believe, 20, 30 different armies already. I believe it's been used in the West Bank and in Gaza, probably. It was used in Kosovo. There was real problems in Europe. The Italians, the Spanish, I think, had real reservations about exposing their troops in Kosovo to the DU leftover, so to speak. It is a dangerous, dangerous thing. I think it's perhaps more dangerous than atomic weapons today because it's cheap and readily available. The U.S. has had great difficulty in recognizing this, likewise the U.K., the two main users. And I saw to my concern this last week, I think it was, that the U.S., the Veterans Administration, I think, has said that the Gulf syndrome now turns out to be something like Lou Gehrig's disease. And the good news is that those with Lou Gehrig's disease as veterans can now have compensation. Well, that's good for the veteran and for his or her family. But it worries me because it looks like we're moving away from pointing the finger at depleted uranium, which just means it's going to be more widespread. And that's very frightening. So it's one of the many issues that have not been resolved. The Iraqis have monitored this, but of course they understand their data has no credibility, so they don't release it. There are some studies. There's a group in Manchester, in England, who work on depleted uranium. Somebody's making a documentary film on DU right now, as a matter of fact. So it's going on, but it's a nightmare scenario, in my view, and it's something we have to really worry about. And I believe the manufacturing plant in this part of New York State, am I right, near the Canadian border, or is it further east, was closed down because there were complaints amongst the community, activists in the community. So this is a dangerous product.
How do you think the possible second full military attack on Iraq will affect the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Wow.
How do you see it affecting, if you think it would significantly?
I don't know what to say on that. I mean, I worry about Iraq's rhetoric vis-a-vis Israel. It's disastrous. I know they've been actively supportive of the Palestinians, one of the few Arab states that actually delivers. You know, they give a check of $10,000 to every family that loses an individual or, you know, in the current intifada. But, you know, you're getting me into an area which I really should not speak to. I don't know enough about it. There may be others here who know much more than I. But I fear that it will not improve things. But it would seem to say to me that the United States' influence over the Arab world and the sort of hopefully positive influence over the Arab world vis-a-vis accepting Israel in some acceptable form as a state, perhaps more integrated, perhaps a federation, I don't know what the model is going to be, that may be lost. And that is going to be perhaps catastrophic for Israel. And I'm not in favor of that, obviously. And in the interim, maybe catastrophic for the Palestinians as well. I mean, this, I don't see anything positive at all coming out of a possible attack on Iraq. That's just bad news, period.
Who is the real Saddam Hussein?
Stand up, please. Where is he? Who is the real Saddam Hussein?
Yes, he's been demonized in the American media, and just as someone who lived through the Gulf conflict as a kid watching CNN, you know, I don't really know what to think of him. If there's anything redeeming about him, or what the, you know, what's the deal with him?
Well, you know, Kathy Kelly will tell you, she went to a primary school up near Mosul a couple of years ago. And she and a group of American activists. And when they went into the school, some of the children screamed and some of the children burst into tears. They had never seen Americans before, and the ones they knew about, they were frightened of, because all they knew about the United States was aircraft going overhead, either dropping something or breaking the sound barrier, generally frightening children. I mean, that's a very scary sort of scenario. But the teacher of this primary school said, you know, you people, you may think that Saddam Hussein is all bad news, but many of us don't think that. I was educated by Saddam Hussein. He paid for my university education in Britain. He has financed a healthcare system which the WHO recognized to be vastly superior to any other Arab state and comparable to Southern Europe. So the Ba'ath Party did a lot of good things. I mean, perhaps it's a political device. I think it is a political device. I mean, the other model I'm familiar with is Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. You provide to people everything the social welfare system requires: housing, education, healthcare, employment. You know, all the good things that most people actually want. And those who've never enjoyed civil and political liberties, you know, you don't miss them if you never had them, do you? So if you've got the other package, well, you know, the civil and political stuff can wait. If you've got a hope for your children, their education, their future, it's pretty good stuff. So a lot of people, you know, remember that aspect of Saddam Hussein. I think privately they must say, you know, you really destroyed us with the Iran-Iraq debacle, which was a nightmare scenario. But, you know, I've been around the Middle East, and I've met taxi drivers in a number of different cities in the Middle East. And, you know, surprising, most of them seems to have worked in Iraq. You know, how was that? Well, the reason is they worked in Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. And to a man, because they all tend to be men, they have the greatest affection for Iraq, the Iraqi people, and its leadership. And as I said, the Arab street looks upon this man as a hero, because he's got the guts where their own government does not have the guts to stand up to the United Nations and to the United States. I've never met the president of Iraq. And the issue comes up, and it came up, I had a very awkward interview with BBC about a month ago. I did a program for them called The Choice. It's a series they do. They interview people for 30 minutes who they feel have made some decision, some significant decision, which has impact on them and whatever. So my resignation was the decision. So I sort of reluctantly did it. Anyway, they played it. But at the end of this thing, it went slightly off the track. I mean, I was really quite concerned. And we got into the Gulf War. The interviewer said, well, you know, of course, Saddam Hussein, this monster. I said, you know, that's really an unfortunate expression to use about the head of state. And he said, well, you know, the man is guilty of terrible, terrible things. I said, yes, that may be true, but you know, so is George Bush. He was outraged that I would compare Saddam Hussein to George Bush Sr. He said, well, how could you possibly do that? What on earth are you, you know, sort of. I said, well, you know, I'm looking at it from the point of view as the commander-in-chief overseeing the Gulf War, being responsible for the use of depleted uranium, being responsible for a military force that probably killed 200,000 people, being responsible for bombing civilian infrastructure that has been responsible for hundreds of thousands of additional deaths, being responsible for burying Iraqi troops alive, being responsible for the Turkey shoot on the Basra Road, quote unquote. You know, that's a lot of pretty heavy stuff. You know, it's hard to pin all that on Saddam Hussein. But, you know, it's a terrible. I regretted immediately I ever got into this horrible discussion on the BBC. But, you know, the man's an amateur. That's what I usually say. In comparison to what we Europeans, I don't know whether I include all of you, but I include myself. We Europeans are the most dangerous people on earth. We invented slavery. We destroyed the aboriginals. We initiated the genocide of the Native Americans. We handled the First War, the Second War. I mean, we are pretty nasty people. I think to point the finger at Saddam Hussein is really a little questionable. Thank you all very much for being so patient. It's been a long evening.
That was former UN official Dennis Halliday. He spoke earlier this month in Ithaca. You're tuned to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. Fred Wilcox is a professor of writing at Ithaca College. He's the author, with Philip Berrigan, of Fighting the Lamb's War: Skirmishes with the American Empire. He attended Halliday's presentation that we just heard and offered the following perspective.
First, let me say that I really admire Dennis Halliday. I think he's doing great work. I admire him for his convictions, that is to say that he quit a very prominent position, very secure position, because of his beliefs, and I really respect people who do that. I was also very happy that he came to Ithaca College. The students really need to hear more people like Dennis Halliday. But like a lot of people, unfortunately, when they speak about the Middle East or poverty in America, whatever it is, he seemed to believe, and I have no reason to believe that he was just being rhetorical, that we live in a democracy. And I have some serious questions about that. I think that if we did live in a democracy, then the mayor of New York, Mr. Bloomberg, who just got elected, wouldn't have been able to buy the election. I don't think in a democracy you can buy elections. A man with $4 billion had no political experience before. Now he's the mayor of New York City. So everybody's listening to him, and every pronouncement he makes now will be very important. But why? Well, why? Because he's a billionaire, and he wanted to be mayor. He obviously was bored. He'd done everything he could as a business person, and then he wanted to be. That's not democracy. Moreover, it seems to me democracy would be a place where the will of the people is actually heard and not manipulated, not created, not manufactured, where people would have a genuine, bona fide opportunity to hear different voices, different things. Let me just give you an example. I was on the way home from Washington, D.C., where I was giving a talk a couple months ago, when the bombing of Afghanistan began. And I turned on the radio of the car I was riding in, and I got NPR. And what did NPR do? NPR just said the same things over and over and over and over again. They said, Mr. Bush said this, Mr. Cheney said this, Mr. So-and-so said this, and this and this and that. And what I looked at all the buttons, and I thought, wouldn't it be interesting, and wouldn't it be democratic, if I could push different buttons on this dial here? I wasn't driving, someone else was driving. And I could get a different perspective, maybe a socialist perspective, a communist perspective, an anarchist. You don't even have to say the is, but just different perspectives. And I couldn't. I got the same perspective all afternoon, all the way back from Washington, D.C. to Ithaca. So to me, that's not democracy. Democracy would be myriad perspectives, different perspectives, radical perspectives, whatever perspective, fascist perspectives. We don't have those. So when Mr. Halliday was talking about democracy, my inclination is always to ask, what do you mean? How do you define that? Because it disturbs me that all these young people are sitting there who probably are as conditioned as I was growing up to believe, yes, we live in a democracy. This is the freest country in the world. You can say whatever you want to. And you can say whatever you want to. It's just that nobody's going to listen to it. It won't make any difference. But this term has certain connotations, you know, denotations, resonance, if you want, that I think is people who use it and use it the way he used it. That is to say, we should export something that we don't practice. How can you export something that you don't practice, you don't have? That's like my saying, you know, I would export money. I don't have money. You know, I'll give to the poor. I can't. I'm poor. So those are some of the things that bothered me. Mostly his insistence that we should export democracy, that we have a democracy, without articulating what that means. Other things, well, I don't call the war, you know, people say the war in Iraq. I think we should never say that. We should say massacre. It wasn't a war. It's not a war in Afghanistan. Those two events, whatever you want to call them, attacks, massacres, are not wars. The United States has figured out not to go to war. We will never go to war again if we can help it. We will bomb civilians. We'll kill anybody by the thousands, 10,000s, hundreds of thousands in order to avoid casualties. we're willing to commit genocide, any crime against humanity in order to protect us, in order to protect our political, quote, system, in order to protect our politicians, keep them in office, and in order to avoid what, you know, what you know and I know is the Vietnam syndrome, as they call it. So I wish Mr. Halliday would have spoken a little more about that. He did talk about the statistics, the 200,000 people killed and this and that, and he did go into some of the details, some of the things that he's seen in the Middle East and seen in Iraq. But I think it's so extreme to me, what we've done to the Iraqi people, what we've done to the children, the massacre of the children, the massacre of the people, the torture, the torment, the genocide, the murder, the violence, and poisoning. And he did talk about depleted uranium, which was great. That was very interesting. And it was just many of the things he said, I just wished he would have elaborated upon and gone a little more into detail and been a little more vivid about, because I know from teaching, I'm a college professor, that if you don't, if you just sort of allude to things or say things rather quickly or in some almost anecdotal style, it will bounce off the students. They are so conditioned, and I'm not blaming them. The educational system has done its job. It has conditioned them. It has brainwashed them. It has hardened them so that you need to give them lots of detail and lots of stories and be very vivid and very, and of course he didn't maybe have time to do all that, but anyway, I think that you need to do more of that. And even to the point of risking being hyperbolic and being, having them respond with, well, that's so extreme, or that sounds just outrageous, or I can't believe that, or the United States wouldn't do that. I also wish that he had gone a little more into detail in that, how can you be a practicing democracy and export a democracy and a terrorist nation at the same time? You know, to me, the United States has been a terrorist nation. Well, maybe from the very beginning, we terrorized the Indians, you know, exterminated them, committed genocide there, terrorized Africans. We've terrorized the workers. The capitalist system, I think, has been a basically terroristic system. And so then we have this so-called benign, beautiful, capitalistic democratic system that we want to export to other people. But I think people in the Middle East, particularly the Arabs, are watching us in our support for Israel, and Israel is terrorizing the people, the Palestinians in the occupied territories, would probably ask the question, what kind of democracy are you talking about? How can you fight terrorism, you know, oppose terrorism, want to bomb people and kill people you call terrorists, when in fact you're terrorists? You've been practicing, you know, been supporting terrorism in Guatemala and El Salvador and in Indonesia and all sorts of places all over the world for decades. So isn't that incompatible with democracy? It seems to me that supporting terrorism and practicing democracy are simply incompatible contradictions in terms. It's like my saying that I'm really a peace activist, but I believe in murder. In case you steal my car, I'm going to kill you. I mean, you're probably going to ask the question, how can you be a pacifist and want to kill me if I steal your car? So I think the United States is just a mass of contradictions. And of course, he couldn't go into all of that. But talking about exporting democracy when, in fact, your nation is involved at that very moment and terrorism acts in Afghanistan, bombing a POW camp with people tied with their hands tied behind the back, bombing thousands of civilians, bombing whole villages off the face of the earth, I just don't really see how you could then say that that nation that is in the process of doing that right there, that night, that moment, could export something called democracy. And again, we can't export what we don't do. We can't export what we don't practice. I mean, you know, you have South Philadelphia, you know, North Philadelphia, you have the Bronx, you have Bedford Stuyvesant, you have, you know, the growing unemployment rate in this country. You're going to have a growing crime. You have 2 million people in prison. You have even the working class that we all know now, and I include myself. Our wages haven't gone up in the last 10 years. You just can't get ahead. You can barely pay your bills. You know, I'm a college professor. I'm supposed to be, you know, a part of the upper class elite. You know, I barely pay my bills. I barely get by. I do not save money. I'm lucky in a sense that I do have the time that I can devote to things. I can listen to programs. I can read. But people who are out there just trying to survive, I grew up in a working class family. I know how it is. My parents used to squabble over the bills every Friday night. I mean, how on earth can you talk about democracy? These people, yes, they're supporting the war in Afghanistan, maybe, because they don't have time. They don't have the energy. They don't have the, you know, a democracy, first of all, would be a place where people had health insurance. They had a good social security system so that when you retire, you have the money, that you had leisure so that you could examine things. There's no leisure in the United States now. Everybody's struggling like crazy just to keep even, just to break even. Well, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, the middle class barely survives. That can't be, that's not a democracy, because it's not a climate in which people even have the time to be reflective. You need time. You need energy to be reflective. If you can't be reflective, then you can't think about the system under which you're living. So we can't export this sort of rat race. I wouldn't. God, I go to Ireland in the summer. I'm an international observer up there. I hate what's happening to Ireland. It's becoming Americanized. Everybody's going faster and faster. Everybody's more and more interested in money. They're slamming these big houses all over the place. Is that what we want to export? I think that's what we are exporting. I mean, in some ways, I'm worried that, you know, what Halliday was talking about is, yes, we do have something to export. We have capitalism, but that's not democracy. And I don't know if he was confusing it or not, but I think we do in this country. My students do. Most people say capitalism and democracy is synonymous with or the same thing as democracy, and I would argue absolutely not. What I think about our country is that if it were an individual, if our government was an individual, if you knew somebody like this, you would want them institutionalized for a while. You would say, this person is so out of touch with reality. You could label schizophrenic, whatever, if you want to put a label on this, but you would say, this person is suffering from serious illusions and delusions and needs help. So the first thing that we would have to do, you know, is listen to Noam Chomsky, look at Howard Zinn, read our history, study our history, deconstruct our history, and start looking about, well, who have we been all these years? What have we really done? What have we really been about? Because why are we bombing Afghanistan? We're bombing Afghanistan because we're the good guys. We lost thousands of people in the World Trade Center, which I mourn, you mourn, everybody mourn. And yet, our response to that is to kill thousands of innocent people in Afghanistan, saying we're the good guys. How are we the good guys? You know, I ask my students, is there a good terrorist and a bad terrorist? You know, is there a benign terrorism and an ugly, awful terrorism? And I think that the United States, I think the point we're at today is that we're mad. We're insane. We're not. It's not even whether somebody agrees with me politically. That isn't even important to me. I'm willing to go there any time of the day or night. But what I hear people saying is, we're bombing Afghanistan. We're going to war. We bomb these, destroy these villages because that's collateral damage, and we have to do that in order to do good. And I ask the question, how can you do any good if you're killing thousands of innocent people? And the answer, I never get an answer. The answer is, well, that's what we do because we're the good people. And I consider that madness. So in order to begin to export democracy, if Mr. Halliday believes in that, we'd have to deconstruct our whole national character, our history and our character. Because I think that what we inherited from our Puritan forefathers and mothers was really a form of madness. That is to say, I can kill the Indians, I can steal their land, and I can do that in the name of God. It's a form of grandiosity that actually eventually leads to total madness. And I think that's where we are. We are God's chosen people. We believe that everything we do in His name is in the name of democracy. And that's why I'm so concerned when somebody like Dennis Halliday gets up and talk about democracy, because the very concept that the students have, you know, that we're doing what we're doing in Afghanistan, because we're going to establish democracy over there, just like we have already in other parts of the world. Well, I don't see any place in the world where we, the United States of America, has established democracy. Quite the contrary. Why would we have the CIA assassinating, killing people all over the earth, people who have tried to establish democracy in Chile or Guatemala or other parts of the world? Any place that people have ever, you know, any place they've ever tried to do that, we've sent the CIA, we've sent the military, we've sent established death squads, and we've said, you will not have democracy because we won't allow it. So again, it's not only something that we don't practice, it seems to me something that we will not allow. We can't export something that we actually seem to despise if it involves ordinary poor people taking control of their own lives. If it's top down, I mean, if we could establish some government and have a little election somewhere and then say, okay, we keep the same thing. You know, 3%, 5% of the people own everything, they control everything. But actually, you've had an election, therefore you have a democracy. That's not democracy again. To me, democracy is the people running their own lives, making their own decisions, and controlling things for themselves, and not being told by the military or the government, well, here's the decisions we've made, and you will go along with it or else. For example, if the American people could ever, you know, be allowed, and I'm saying be allowed, to look at their own system, if they could deconstruct it, if they could look at it, they would see clearly that, first of all, paying taxes the way we do, then the amount of taxes that I pay is about as undemocratic as you could get. I have no say about it except that I can go to jail or I can protest. I can have my house taken away. There are various ways that I can protest. But basically, somebody's made that decision. That is to say that the rich would pay a certain small percent of their taxes. I, in my practice, will pay about 30% of my taxes. That's anti-democratic. In fact, I think democracy is very radical. Democracy is more like what Thomas Jefferson was talking about when he said that every 20 years there ought to be a revolution in the United States. Democracy would be people looking at everything critically and analyzing everything and saying, look, I'm not going to pay another goddamn cent to build weapons. No, you know, I'm not going to do this. Why? Well, because I don't want to kill women and children, because I don't want to kill my own family, because I don't want to terrorize anybody, and because I can't see why this is, how this is really building a better world or a better country or a better city, town, or whatever. It's not benefiting all of the people. So forget it. I won't do it. But of course, you know, the system has ways to say, well, you do, will do it. And at the same time, you will believe that you're doing it because you live in a democracy. You know, I believe in nonviolent revolution. I think that the only hope for this country would be what Jefferson was talking about and others were talking about way back, you know, in the 1700s. I don't think that there's any hope. I think the system, the American system, is so corrupt. It's so vile. It's so money-oriented. It's so dominated by it's a military-industrial complex. The military has so much power here. I mean, just go to some other country and watch government officials have a press conference. They're not surrounded by military people, unless it's Peru or someplace. You know, you go to Ireland, people come out, sometimes they hardly have a tie on. You know, there's no military man standing on both sides of them. This is what we have here. We have an oligarchy, you know, at best here. Military-industrial complex. So I see no hope for it. It's too far gone. We've gone too far one way. Anybody who opposes it will be either silenced, ignored. So what we need here is a total nonviolent revolution. We need to overthrow this government. The government is hopeless. Both parties are hopeless. Anybody who believes in Democratic or Republican Party, I think, is very naive. Liberals are like children who still believe in Santa Claus. They just insist, in spite of all evidence, you know, well, yes, he will appear. I'll see him come down my chimney. I'll see democracy come down the chimney. Democracy's not coming down the chimney. You know, a democracy in Washington, D.C. is simply lobbyists. You know, the Israeli lobby, the most powerful lobby in the United States, telling our congressmen, you know, if we had a democracy, we would have people, congressional people, men and women there, with the courage to stand up and say, we cannot allow any country to kill daily women and children, smash tanks through neighborhoods, to come in with F-16s and bomb buildings right near schools. We can't allow that to happen. But you see, people in Washington, they don't have the courage because they know what will happen to them. They'll be thrown out of office at best, you know, and other things could happen to them. They know what will happen to them. So that's not a democracy. Democracy, again, would be a place where at least our elected representatives would have the courage to speak clearly and openly about things that I suspect that a lot of them know are wrong. And, you know, deep down in their hearts and minds, they would probably like to speak up. They're not terrible, you know, dishonest, all of them. They're not evil people, but they're frightened, you know. And again, I think democracy and fear are incompatible, and this is one of the most fearful countries in the world today. Americans are desperately frightened of everything, of losing jobs, of the police, of terrorism, of the economy, of being homeless. Of my students, young people, are terrified. They're terrified they won't get jobs, they won't be successful, they'll wind up out of the streets, a terrorist will kill them. How can that be democracy? Democracy and fear are just incompatible. You can't have a people as frightened as the United States people in a democracy. That's just not going to happen. I think the essential thing, the essential problem is that we in the United States worship war. I was looking through, I never read the Sunday Times, but I looked at it yesterday. I think 6 out of the best-selling non-fiction books were war books. 6. Now it's around Christmas time. My Jesus Christ, what are people doing giving Tom Brokaw's, everybody's writing a war book. There's oral histories, there's this history, that history, World War II, World War I, all of a sudden war, not all of a sudden, but war has sort of been revitalized here to the point where, and that's why I say fascism, because if you look at Nazi Germany, if you look at any country where fascism took control, well, it was directly, there was a direct correlation between the government, the power the government had, and the war, you know, that these countries inflicted upon other people, the violence. And we have become, we love war. We just adore it. And, of course, we adore it now because we're not losing any casualties. I mean, you listen to Rumsfeld talk, we're fighting Al-Qaeda. The Marines are out there hunting down people. But nobody even hardly gets wounded. You know, isn't that? I mean, again, and I think that's very important because what we're developing here is the myth. I mean, what we're creating here through our casualty-less wars, those wars that we have, we bomb Iraq, we bomb with our super weapons, demonstrating to the world that we have these sci-fi weapons and nobody can ever defy us. We're also creating the myth of the Superman kind of warrior, you know. And that's very scary to me because that is definitely a part of fascism. You see these creatures on TV, these Marines or these special ops, and they're dressed in these incredibly sci-fi looking uniforms. And they look like bullets will actually bounce off of them. And I think that's very important for the government to do that. It's very important for the government to convince the American people, take a look at these. I think the shots are deliberate. When you see them on TV, they're very deliberate. What you're seeing is this mythical, supernatural, invincible, heroic military figure. And so that the Americans are getting, again, into their head, we are invincible. We are the super race. No one can defeat us anywhere on Earth. We can destroy everybody, and we will never have any casualties. And that's fascism. That's what it is.
That was Professor Fred Wilcox of Ithaca College, responding to Dennis Halliday's analysis of U.S. foreign policy and the question of democracy. We'll conclude tonight's program with an excerpt of a talk by Professor Noam Chomsky of MIT, which analyzes the credibility of the U.S. government's justifications for the continued hostilities toward Iraq. The talk was originally given in August of 2000 and was a response to the resumption of bombing in Iraq by the Clinton administration. The talk is titled Case Studies in Hypocrisy, U.S.-Iraq Policy. For a link to the entire 53-minute lecture, which we unfortunately don't have time to broadcast in its entirety on the program tonight, please visit our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome, where a link to the audio will be provided.
There's a kind of a reasonable way to proceed to figure out what the motives are. We can run through possibilities, see if some of them can be excluded. We can sort of narrow it down on some possibilities that are left. The one that immediately comes to mind, and the first one to pay attention to, is the one that is universally expressed and vociferously expressed. And there was one reason for it, and it's a standard one. Saddam is a vengeful despot, who has already used chemical and biological weapons on his own citizens, which is the ultimate horror. Now, obviously, such a creature has to be destroyed, poses an enormous threat, can't be tolerated, so you bomb him, you impose sanctions, and so on. Well, that justification does have at least one merit. It's very easily tested. You simply have to ask, what was the U.S.-British reaction when Saddam Hussein carried out the ultimate horror, that is, used chemical weapons against his own people? He certainly did, no doubt that he's a monster. And he certainly carried out this act of his vengeful despot who has used chemical weapons against his own people. That's undoubtedly true, namely in 1988, when he carried out a major, several times, gassing campaign against Kurds. He also used nerve gas and chemical weapons and other chemical weapons and so on the war against Iran that was just finishing up at that time. In fact, the use of increased till the end. So it happened, and there is a reaction on the part of the United States and Britain. You can see what that reaction is. It's on the record. You know. Well, the reaction was that the United States and Britain increased their support for their favorite monster. They'd been supporting him avidly right through his worst crimes. And after the gassing, they increased the support. So how did they increase the support? Well, in some interesting ways. The U.S. had been providing Iraq with all kinds of aid. Particularly at that point, they increased the Reagan and later Bush administrations increased the subsidized food aid. Subsidized means, you know, you guys are paying for it. Subsidized agricultural exports to Iraq. Now, why did, you know, Iraq is an agricultural producer, had been a country which one of the few countries in the region which was actually an efficient producer of food and even exporter, so what did it need agricultural exports for? Well, that was actually connected to the gassing of the Kurds. I mean, Saddam Hussein, the vengeful despot, was destroying agricultural areas and the people who lived in them. So therefore, there was actually a food shortage. And therefore, we had come to the rescue to help out with this project of gassing the Kurds in the north. So during the invasion of Panama, George Bush took off a moment to announce that we were going to increase this is December 1989, a year later, we're going to increase the credits to Iraq to allow them to purchase from U.S. agricultural and other producers. It wasn't just agricultural. I don't think this was reported in the press, nor, as far as I could discover, was it reported that one senator, Senator Inouye from Hawaii, thought this was kind of surprising and asked for clarification. And he was given an official clarification by the State Department, which, again, I don't think was reported. He was told official government policy that we were going to increase our support for our favorite vengeful despot and mass murderer. They didn't say that. But we were going to increase the support to Saddam Hussein. That's the Globe. Because, here it is, it would increase U.S. exports and put the United States in a better position to deal with Iraq on human rights issues. Okay. Well, there didn't have to be any laughter because it wasn't reported. But at that time, let's forget the small thing about increasing U.S. exports, meaning increasing the profits for agribusiness and the high technology industry and so on. At that time, the line was we are in a better position to deal with Iraqi human rights issues if we subsidize the monster. A year later, it turned out that we were in a better position to deal with human rights issues if we starve the Iraqi people into submission. Somehow you're not supposed to notice that the line changed for some reason. But whatever reason it changed for clearly had nothing to do with the ultimate horror, the using of chemical weapons against his own people, because that had already happened, and it just led us to increase the support. This issue certainly has arisen. I mean, for example, Madeleine Albright, as perhaps you recall, was asked on national TV about a year or 2 years ago, I guess, what she thought about the fact that it was reported that about 500,000 Iraqi children had died as a result of the sanctions. And she said she agreed that this was a hard choice, but she said, we think the price is worth it. Okay, so that's the moral level of the way in which we deal with Iraqi human rights violations by killing 500,000 Iraqi children. We think the price is, we're willing to pay that price. The subsidies for our favorite killer when he was carrying out the ultimate horror were not restricted to subsidized agricultural exports. They also included technical equipment, dual-use equipment, equipment that could be used for military purposes, helicopters, for example, a lot of equipment which could even be used for production of chemical and biological warfare. This was all revealed afterwards. That went on. At the time, there was suspicion that Saddam Hussein had biological warfare facilities. The U.S. denied it. Because he's our friend, after all, he wouldn't do that sort of thing. But they were discovered by a very good journalist. He was at that time the Middle East reporter for ABC television, Charlie Glass. He was able to find high-level Iraqi defectors in London, in general, actually. And from information that he got from them, using French commercial satellites, which are low grade, but certainly nothing like what the Pentagon has, he was able to locate and identify biological warfare facilities. And ABC television let him run a spot on the news showing biological warfare facilities, giving the evidence from defecting Iraqi generals. Then they switched immediately to their Pentagon correspondent, who poo-pooed it, said, no, the Pentagon says this is nonsense. Forget about it, and the story died. Now, those same biological warfare facilities are being presented as proof that this reincarnation of Attila the Hun has to be destroyed by massacring his population. Same ones, and you're not supposed to remember that either. Right, according to Iraqi disms, there has been for a long time a ban, an official ban, U.S. government ban, against any contact with Iraqi disms, the democratic opposition. It's not because they're big radicals or anything like that. Head is a London banker, others are professionals. But there was a ban, and according to Iraqi disidents, that ban was instituted forcefully right after the last gassing episode so as not to irritate our friend Saddam Hussein. I can't vouch for that, but that the ban has been in operation is absolutely true. In fact, it's been reiterated repeatedly. We got up to December 1989, January 1990, a few months after that, in April, a group of high-ranking U.S. senators went to Iraq. They met with Saddam in the Kurdish city of Mosul. Remember, the Kurds are the ones who are getting gassed. The delegation was headed by Robert Dole, who brought the president's greetings to Saddam. Alan Simpson, he was in the delegation. He told Saddam that Saddam's problems are not with the American government, which has no objections to him. They are with some journalists, kind of loose cannons. And he advised Saddam that what he should do is invite them to Iraq so they could kind of see for themselves, you know, be disabused of these notions. Well, that's up to April 1990. That's already 2 years after the Halabja massacre, the ultimate horror. This continues up until the day of the invasion of Kuwait. That's when, overwhelmingly, Saddam Hussein's crimes were committed during that period. Some of the worst ones were committed afterwards, I'll come to that. But the major ones were committed up till that period, and the U.S. supported him all the way through, in fact, with a good deal of enthusiasm. So did Britain. That tells us something. It tells us that they cannot, just by elementary logic, the crimes can't be the reason why we have to destroy the monster. Well, what about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein? Well, that's real. That threat peaked in the late 1980s, thanks to our support. That's the time when he was most threatening and most powerful. There's a measure of how great the threat was. He was then at war. He had attacked Iran with our support, and there was a war going on. He was unable to defeat Iran. That's a country which had just decimated its officer corps and top military at the time of the revolution, Khomeini revolution. Even with the Iranian military largely decimated, Iraq was unable to defeat them with the support of the United States, Russia, Britain, Western Europe, and the Arab states. So that gives you a measure of the threat at its peak. Today, in comparison, Iraq is... Well, as Charlie Glass again wrote in a recent article, the Iraqi army is approximately back to what it was when the British established it as a means to suppress the population violently so that the rulers would be able to export oil to the West and ensure that the profits go to the West, not to the people of the region. That's the role of most of the armies in the Middle East. And the Iraqi army is about back to that level. Its equipment is antiquated, far weaker than it was. A lot of the weapons have been destroyed, not so much by bombing, but by the inspection system, which has destroyed a lot of weapons, and of course, by the destruction of the economy. So, yes, it's a threat. It was a much greater threat 10 years ago. And how did the U.S. and Britain react to the threat at its peak? The main reaction was to increase the threat. That was the reaction at the peak of the threat. And the U.S. took it very seriously. You want to remember how serious it was, bear in mind that Iraq in May, I think, 1987, Iraqi missiles struck the U.S. destroyer Stark, killing 37 sailors, and they got a kind of tap on the wrist, but that's it. That shows you you're really committed to somebody. What was the U.S. Stark doing there? Well, the U.S. Navy at that time was being introduced into the Gulf to back up Iraq and support them in the war against Iran and, of course, in his war against his own population. That alliance strengthened a year later in July 1988. Another U.S. warship, the Vincennes, shot down an Iranian commercial airliner just taking off from Iranian airport. A commercial airliner killed 290 people. Was plainly in a commercial check corridor. In fact, the ship was in Iranian territorial waters. Iran recognized the reality. They might be able to fight a war with Iraq, but they could not fight an Iraqi-U.S. alliance. The U.S. claimed, it's not credible, that, as I'm taking very seriously, that it was mistaken for an Iranian military plane, but the Iranian Air Force pointed out right away that the U.S. was not shooting down low-flying Iraqi planes, which were very visible and indeed were war planes. Iran recognized at the time that the game is over. They can't, and they essentially capitulated shortly after that. Well, that's the peak of the Iraqi threat, thanks to our contribution. And Saddam, in fact, used his increased power very quickly. 5 days after the ceasefire, he turned to another major gas attack against Kurds in the north. 5 days after the ceasefire, the U.S. reaction I've already described. Well, just to put this together, and we've now at least eliminated one candidate for what the motives were, namely the candidate that is universally presented just on grounds of elementary logic. There is an event that did change Saddam Hussein from favored friend to the beast of Baghdad, namely August 2nd, 1990, when he invaded Kuwait. What about that? Is that why we have to sanction, you know, impose the sanctions that are killing people and so on? Well, that's pretty hard to argue. For one thing, he's not in Kuwait. Was that a major crime? Sure, it's a war crime. You know, invading another country is a war crime. That's a thing for which people were hanged at Nuremberg and so on. On the other hand, was it a serious crime? Well, pretty hard to argue. In comparison with the rest of Saddam's criminal record, which we had supported, it's like adding a toothpick to a mountain. Furthermore, it was recognized by the United States not to be a very serious crime. In fact, the great fear of U.S. leaders at the time of the invasion, as Colin Powell put it, chief of staff, is that Iraq would quickly withdraw, leaving a puppet regime in place, and then all the Arab states would be happy. That was the expectation. In fact, it was called the nightmare scenario. They were afraid it might happen. How much of a crime would that have been? Well, we can measure that, too. If, in fact, the expectations of the U.S. leadership had been fulfilled, Saddam would have essentially duplicated what the United States had just done a couple of months ago in Panama. That is, invaded, put in a puppet government, and then withdrawn, leaving it in place. The puppet government happened to be a government of bankers and narco traffickers and so on. But it was in place, and it's maintained essentially by U.S. force, but from a distance. So Saddam, the only real difference between the two cases is that Colin Powell may have been correct in saying that the Arabs would have been, all the Arab states would have been happy, but it certainly wasn't true of Latin America. There was tremendous opposition to the U.S. invasion in Panama and elsewhere, and indeed that remains. Other than that, the analogy is pretty close. In the case of Panama, the U.S. was able to veto two Security Council resolutions condemning it, vote against a General Assembly resolution, which effectively vetoes it. In the case of Iraq, however, the U.S., of course, the resolution stood. Subsequent events took place, which are worth going over, which I'll skip for lack of time, but what they essentially amounted to was U.S. efforts, with the strong cooperation of the media, to suppress the possibilities that this nightmare scenario might take place and to ensure that the conflict would end in the arena of force and violence, where the U.S. is, of course, supreme. Then comes, we're up to February 1991, the Gulf massacre. It ended at the end of the month, and shortly afterwards, within days, Saddam Hussein turned to the next most serious crimes of his career. Immediately after the war, there was an uprising in southern Iraq, in the Shiite areas of the south, led by rebelling Iraqi generals. This is right under the nose of the U.S. Army, which dominated the whole region. You know, Storm and Norman is sitting there watching it, following orders from Washington. The rebelling generals did not ask for assistance. they asked for access to captured Iraqi equipment that was supported by Saudi Arabia, who also requested the United States to allow them to have at least access to captured Iraqi equipment. The U.S. refused. It refused to do anything to deter the vicious Iraqi response, Iraqi government response, which was brutal and murderous, even to let the rebels have access to equipment. They wanted, the U.S. clearly wanted, and in fact had to say that it wanted the revolt to fail. And it failed. It was crushed with extreme violence. Right after that, a revolt began in the north, Kurdish areas, and the same story reenacted. The U.S. refused to act to give any assistance whatsoever to the rebels in fear that they might succeed, that is, they might overthrow the beast of Baghdad. So immediately, in short, immediately after the war was over, the U.S. essentially returned to support for its favorite murderer, as he again carried out really atrocious and vicious acts. Well, that was kind of too visible to suppress at the time, so there was an official justification for it, and it remains until today. True, you know, this offended our sensibilities and so on, but it was necessary in order to maintain something called stability. Stability is very important. You have to maintain stability. The State Department line, as it was presented by its representative at the New York Times, that's the position called chief diplomatic correspondent, was that what he said, the best of all worlds from the point of view of the United States, the best of all worlds would be an iron-fisted military junta that would rule Iraq just the way Saddam Hussein had done. But it would be nice if it didn't have Saddam Hussein's name on it, because that's kind of embarrassing. And so it continues. Just yesterday, the general who heads the Central Command said essentially the same thing the day before. It was reported in yesterday's paper, General Zini. Furthermore, just to add to the story, during this very same period, early 90s, our favorite ally, Turkey, which has one of the worst human rights records in the world, was increasing its own murderous attack against the Kurds in southeastern Turkey from 19. Just as one measure of that, about 1 million Kurds fled to Diyarbakir, the sort of unofficial Kurdish capital in southeastern Turkey, during those years. 1994 was a peak year in two respects. It was the year in which Turkish terror against the Kurds peaked, and it was the year in which U.S. military aid to Turkey peaked. In fact, in that year, Turkey became the world's leading importer of U.S. arms. Those are two things that typically go along together. There's a very close correlation between terror and violence and U.S. military aid. Well, somehow that didn't mean that we had to impose sanctions on the people of Turkey to kill hundreds of thousands of their children. Well, without proceeding, it's plain that there cannot have been any moral or humanitarian motive behind anything that's going on, and it certainly cannot possibly have been the official motives. It cannot be Saddam's crimes that are motivating this. That, again, is just elementary logic. What about the threat of weapons of mass destruction? Well, suppose we're concerned about weapons of mass destruction. Then one question, obviously, is how come it wasn't true in 1988, when it was a much more serious threat than it is today? Second question is, the latest bombings, for example, are part of the justification is that they were supposed to reduce Saddam's capacity to produce weapons of mass destruction, but it was conceded at once, in advance, in fact, that the bombings would have the opposite effect. They would increase that capacity. That was conceded because it was obvious. The major effect of the bombing would be to eliminate UNSCOM, the UNSCOM inspections. In fact, at least if you can believe Scott Ritter, one of the chief inspectors who resigned from UNSCOM about a year ago, the U.S. had already undermined UNSCOM by turning it into a spy agency. Which essentially destroyed it, he said, so I quit. Whether he's right or not about that, probably is. And the inspection mission is the regime is the only thing that has cut back weapons. And it's been pretty successful, in fact. quite successful. If you look at the official war aims last December, they made it pretty clear. They said the official aim is to degrade Saddam's weapons capacity. And as a number of people noticed, that means they had no war aim at all. Because, you know, you shoot one bullet at a door and you degrade the capacity. It's meaningless. There were no credible war aims. But what's interesting is it doesn't matter. I mean, the fact that there are no credible war aims and that the standard reason doesn't even rise to the level of a joke doesn't matter at all. It's still a just attack, and we must march in a parade, right? In other words, we must act as if we're in a totalitarian society, following orders, marching in a parade, even though we recognize that the marching orders are idiotic and would collapse under 30 seconds of inquiry, and that the motive for this last attack is that, you know, that the effect of it will be the opposite of what's claimed. Going back to weapons of mass destruction, there is indeed a way to eliminate the capability of producing one and only one way, and that is a Carthaginian solution. You totally destroy the society. You do that, they won't be able to produce weapons of mass destruction. If you leave an infrastructure, you know, you leave educational and scientific facilities of any kind, and if there's a revenue flow, then you get a capacity to produce weapons of mass destruction. So the only way to end that capability, you know, we talk about terminating it, yeah, there is a way. Wipe the place out. Now, that won't happen for a simple reason. Iraq is the second largest oil producer in the world, and that's much too valuable to wipe out. But, of course, you can wipe out its population. In fact, it's, in a way, beneficial to do that. You look at the history of oil production around the world, you find that it's mostly takes place, its focus on, and what's prized is areas where there aren't very many people. You know, a lot of oil, but not too many people. Because then there's no pressure to, or little pressure, to stop the profits from going to the people who really should have them, Western oil companies, the U.S. Treasury, and so on. So if the population of Iraq were reduced marginalized somehow, maybe reduced to such a level, maybe not murdered, but reduced to such a level that they're barely functional, then by the time when the time comes to bring Iraqi production back into line, as it will, there'll be less of an impediment. It'll be more like, say, Saudi Arabia, where there's a lot of oil, but no people around pressing for economic development and educational facilities and so on and so forth.
That was Professor Noam Chomsky speaking last year on the ongoing U.S. policy of war with Iraq.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.